Get the easy-to-use ABC Radio app. Find details at the RN homepage.
This is Big Ideas on RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. You're used to having some influence on politics through your vote, of course, and possibly by taking to the streets to make your views known. But have you heard of citizen juries? Some state and local governments have called on citizens like you and me to help make tough decisions about infrastructure, long-term budgeting, or reforming the electoral system. This new form of deliberative government has the potential to radically alter the way all tiers of Australian government make decisions. It's demonstrated the public has a valuable role to play in formulating complex policy and solving difficult problems. So how are citizen juries changing the nature of democratic decision-making? Professor Janet Hartz-Karp of the Curtin University Sustainability Policy Institute and Ian Walker, CEO of the New Democracy Foundation, have led the implementation of participatory democracy projects on the West and East Coasts, respectively. This is the second of this year's Swinburne Leadership Dialogues, moderated by Andrew Dodd, Director of the University's Journalism Program.
Janet, let me ask you firstly, what is deliberative democracy?
Sure. It's simply a new form of sharing power where lay people, non-aligned lay people, understand the issues, the data, different viewpoints. They come to a coherent voice forward, and that's influential.
Is it always coherent?
Yes, in the sense that they can always have good reasons, and they make those reasons transparent for the decisions they come up with. So I've run, I think, something like 40 of these events, and I have never not come to a coherent way forward.
Great. We hear other terms, Ian, like citizens' jury and participatory democracy. Are all these terms interchangeable? Are they the same thing, essentially?
They're not all the same thing. There's ways to do participation well, there's ways to do it badly. The starting point for us is really, let's not do government by opinion poll. What's the opposite of that? I don't care what you think in the next 5 seconds. I care more what you think having spent 40 or 50 hours on it and discussed it with other people. That's really the participation revolution. It's not clicktivism. It's not grabbing snapshots and saying I've spoken to a million people for 6 seconds. It's speaking to 50 or 100 people for a considerable period of time. And if they can find agreement, surely that helps government.
So the participation, the deliberation, they're key words. It tells us something about the way this is done.
Absolutely. Deliberation is what it means. Don't rush to judgment. Too often, one of the most common things I hear from local government is they've gone out and asked the community their view. And what do they hear? Well, I want more services and lower rates. That's completely useless. If you actually pose people a problem and say, what's the services you want in your area? This is not a wish list. This is a trade-off exercise. You can have more of something. Just tell the council concerned how you're going to pay for it. You can have less rates, by all means. Tell us what you can live without. And it's getting to a trade-off, whereas democracy has become inherently a wish list. All we ever see are political campaigns where people say, I will give you this for free. You never see the price tag.
Okay, I imagine that something like this emerges not out of a vacuum, but out of a perceived problem. One of the problems, as Ian's described, is our kind of wish list mentality with democracy. There are other problems too that have been at the heart of what you've been doing in WA.
Yeah, for me, the basic problem is that people simply do not trust governments anymore. It doesn't matter where we look, local government, state government, federal government, across the Western world, less than 50%, sometimes 25% of the people say they have any trust in government at all. These are the people we have elected, apparently, to make decisions on our behalf. What are we going to do to give a government more legitimacy, more credibility? We've got to do something different. We can't keep doing what we're doing. What do we do differently? We learn from our history. We go back to what they were doing at the origins of democracy, Athenian democracy. We use random sample. We stop pretending that people are dumb. They're inherently incredibly smart. When they work together, they understand each other and they understand the data. They come up with wise decisions. Government has an enormous advantage in making use of that instead of pretending they don't exist.
All right, so you start with that lovely notion, that idea. How do you go from that to implementing it? I mean, this is an incredibly long process, I imagine, but how does it start?
It'll often start with someone who perceives there's a problem already. And I had the most extraordinary opportunity where someone in opposition was convinced by a story that I gave that if you ever get into government, surely you could do something better. And this person who ended up being a Minister of Planning and Infrastructure on the West, she's very well known, Alana McTiernan, said, okay, you've got when she did get in, you've got 6 months, make this happen. But she had some huge problems to deal with. And indeed, the very first one I dealt with, I got a death threat. I mean, it was that awful to some people that it was their livelihood. And we got people sitting in a room, and we called it sitting at a bad wedding, where we had everybody sitting next to someone they couldn't stand or could never get along with. We had random sample people sitting next to people who lived on or near main roads where these road trucks came down and killed people, sitting next to truck drivers, sitting next to environmentalists. Every single one of them had to understand the other, understand the data, understand the viewpoint, and at the end of one day, they figured out how to move forward. One day!
Before we move forward, I want to move back. Alana McTiernan rings you up. So you've been talking about this in the abstract, not putting it into practice, and suddenly a politician who's now in power rings you up and says, I want to make a punt. I want to go out on a limb on this and back you. Is that what happened?
It is. It was also inherently clear, I think, although it was never made clear, that if I stuffed up, I didn't have a job any more than 5 minutes. I mean, I do think that she's an incredible practical person. She figured I could make this happen. We did, because it works. I mean, all you've got to do is do it well, and it works.
Was she prescriptive about the thing that she wanted you to have a go at fixing, or did you go back to her and say, let's have a go at trying to solve this problem?
No, she knew she had a problem. She came into power, the government had said no more trucks will go down this steep hill, and there was an uproar. She was absolutely destroying, you know, typical Labour, we're destroying democracy as we know it, you're destroying the economy as we know it. She had a problem. She said, we fix that. She also created obstacles for me. She said, I want members of Parliament, whether they be ministers or opposition or whoever they be, I want them to be the facilitators at the table. No! So she asked me, why not? I said, because they don't know how to listen. So she said, no, if they don't experience it, they'll never understand it. So I said, okay, but we do a 2-hour listening session first. They agreed, she agreed, we did. And only one of them was a total stuff-up. I mean, the others really did okay. Some of them very well, others okay. And that's how we started out.
So the essential ingredients there for change was that you had a champion, someone who gave you the green light, but then you had to mould the circumstances and
Absolutely.
The politicians in that instance to get them to work within the paradigm that you were operating in.
Absolutely. Or we had the opposition sitting in as observers. I mean, we had to find ways, and newspapers. So we often got the newspapers involved up front. We did everything we could to at least give ourselves a level playing field.
Have you been championed? Is that how you've got projects up and running?
Absolutely. If we look at how we've approached it, all our conversations generally start with an elected representative. And our first question is, so what's hard? And we don't have a position on any issue, so I'm not chasing down energy issues or budgetary issues. We simply want to know, where are you falling prey to the problems of vox pop democracy, where you're going to get flogged on a headline, whatever decision you take?
Can you give me an example of it?
Look, the easiest one was with Premier Wetherill when he came to power. We had a meeting there. We said, what's hard? Alcohol regulation. And if you think about this, very simple terms, like many capital cities, they have an issue where a couple of 18 to 24-year-old males will probably die in a fight in any given summer after having 10 drinks and bumping into each other. For the purpose of an elected representative, you can follow this. If you act to increase regulation around alcohol, sing along. You are the nanny state. You are the fun police. That's not going to happen. So you don't act. You leave things as they are. You are asleep at the wheel. You are not protecting our kids. So both courses of action are inherently fraught. The one that Premier Wetherill brought up, which really goes to Jeanette's point about trust. The Premier said, I could put the 20 greatest minds in alcohol regulation into a glass box, ask them to come out with a policy which I take sight unseen to the Parliament. and 95% of punters out there will think the Australian Hotels Association wrote it for them. There is, you know, we receive donations, they receive donations. That link with money means even with purity of intent and purity in delivery, we still don't achieve trust. Help me overcome that. That's the kind of brief we respond to. And absolutely, this only happens with elected representatives who want to take a risk. It is risky doing this. Government is absolutely used to saying, I understand the end result will be this. Let's go and work to that point. We deal in uncontrolled results.
Okay, can I again take you back a step? You're in Jay Weatherall's office and Jay says, I want you to solve the problem of nightlife getting out of control in Adelaide. How did you get into Jay Weatherall's office? What happened before that?
We created an organisation, so I'm going to go back even before your question. There's a starting point question of who would you trust to let you reform and tinker with democracy? It's a really hard question to answer. Understanding your background, would I trust the media to recommend that to me? Probably not. The starting point for most people, if you say, I have a better democratic model, is get elected. So we started to go through all these objections. You can't be about a given issue. We need to reform democracy because the government's making a bad fist of policy X. No, you're about the policy. You're an ideology. You've got a leaning. So we had to be of no view. When we did an energy inquiry, we made quite clear to MPs on both sides, we don't care if it's all wind power or whether we're incinerating kittens. We have no view at all. It lands where it lands. We took politicians from both sides of politics. So Jeff Gallop, Nick Greiner are people who've been there and done that. When people say to me, get elected, I say, talk to them. How did we end up in Weatherall's office? Connect the dots. We picked up the phone. So I think to achieve change, there are many ways, many contested ways of how you get your voice heard. Our strategy is to go to those who've been there and done that. First term MPs tend to be somewhat receptive to what we do. Third term MPs tend to be very receptive to what they do because they've hit every limitation in the system along the way. So that tends to be how we get the open
door. But
that's
a state government, right? So yep. You've started at a lower tier of government. You've started at local councils. And that, I believe, was quite deliberate, wasn't it? That you started at that level and worked up.
It was a deliberate strategy. If you were to say, ask Luca, who philanthropically supports what we do.
Tell us who Luca is.
So Luca Belgiorno-Nettis is part of the family that started Transfield. As a result, he got hit up for political donations pretty much from when he could walk. He went to a series of fundraising dinners in 2005, said, I think we need to reform how we do democracy. We all write checks and pretend it's out of civic contribution, and it's not. So I'll write you one more check and you put reform of how we do democracy on the table. And the politician concerned said, you'll write your check anyway because nothing will change. And it's just the wrong thing to say to the wrong person. That's how we came into being as a foundation. They didn't write another donation check. We sit with generous philanthropic backing, able to do this kind of work. Luca had looked at what he wanted to do in democracy, and the brief to me is, there's probably 20 people in the country who can afford to change how we do democracy, and 18 of them are maybe not the people we want to go to for that.
Right, so you started local councils.
Yes.
And that was about getting councils one by one to embrace projects so that it would have a snowball effect?
Yes. I mean, Luca's brief to me is, I want to tip out the Senate. You know, he looks at it and says, what do we gain from having partisan continuity between the lower and upper house? It's meant to be a house of review. That doesn't break down state lines. I'd like to see our laws reviewed by 70 or 100 people we pick at random. And it's a fabulous idea, and I had to be the one to say, perhaps they're not going to let us tip out the Senate. We need to prove that this works. So I'm going to take the area where people will let us tinker. We're going to go and knock on the doors of a few local councils, find a problem, and see if everyday people can solve it. And the first council we knocked on was Canada Bay.
Look, now we're being successful. It is being picked up almost despite us. So my work in Geraldton happened to be because of someone who was involved. But of all people, the director of the Library of Alexandria, Egypt, has also now asked me to go over there because their democracy is not working either. And they're really in trouble. And I find that intriguing. What happens where little Geraldton, you know, this no place up north in Australia, gets published, gets heard, and in Alexandria, in Egypt, where the terrible problems that they're having, they see this as an option. I find that hugely exciting.
Well, let's talk about Geraldton and what you've done there. How long have you been there and how did you get in the door?
Yeah, this has been a 4-year initiative. And I got in the door because the CEO, in this instance, not an elected official, he was a planner in one of the deliberations that I did down south when I was working for the minister. He'd seen this happening. I talked to his sustainability officer, told the sustainability officer I was doing some work in Fremantle. Really friendly, nice, easy place to work. He told his CEO, the CEO wrote and said to me instantly, I'll give you $100,000 a year if you come up and work in Geraldton. I didn't like Geraldton. It's not my favourite place to be. But $100,000 a year? I'm university. We have no money. That sounds fantastic. Right, we're off. We got a grant as well from the federal government. And this is 4 years. But we had some upfront agreements, just like I did with the minister. Number one, every time I do anything, their local council and CEO have to say the extent to which it will be influential. If they can't say that, I'm not going near it. Secondly, I wanted it to be about a sustainability. Every tough issue that comes down the pipeline, I want to be able to do this on that tough issue. And he agreed to that. Thirdly, I do not want the same people in the room as we always have. All the lobby groups, all the people who care, and they're lovely. Every community's got to have them. I wanted everyday lay citizens. And we weren't going to do anything less than a day. We needed people to understand the issues, understand the trade-offs, and sometimes they lasted over 8 days. So he agreed. We worked for 4 years, and we did some extraordinary work to a point where, you know, we've won awards from across the globe, and that's really exciting.
Can you sum up what you've achieved in Geraldton that wouldn't have otherwise happened if you hadn't practiced deliberative democracy?
Simple things like people said, we got no trees, and they worked together and prioritised it. 1 million trees are being planted. We've got no bike paths. We would like to be the bike capital of the West. We now have bike paths, including going by the very wealthy, who until that time had right on the beach, absolutely precluded any bike paths going past their places. And that was because of the agreement that we had with a local paper that they would, and they used their Facebook to say, you got issues, come on our Facebook. 3,000 people came on Facebook and said, get those people out of the way. We want our bike path past their place. It went. We got people who are willing to fund alternative energy. We got the producers and the suppliers and everybody together. And they agreed we could not only do alternative energy for Geraldton, but we could supply Perth. The federal government was willing to support. We got them all to agree. Unfortunately, our premier at the time said he doesn't like alternative energy, so we didn't actually do anything with it. But we had the agreement to move forward. They're huge issues. They're not just minor issues.
Well, I read one of your papers where you described the Geraldton experience, and you said that initially Geraldton wasn't ready for such a radical idea. It was considered too high a risk. There was distrust between the community and the administration. The elected officials were very wary. They weren't ready to hand over power. And interestingly, there was a lack of civic infrastructure to steward the initiative. And that, interestingly, you said one of the few examples of civic infrastructure in Geraldton was around sports clubs, but there wasn't a lot of other infrastructure there to help you. And there was just too much bad history. With all of those things counting against you, I wonder why you took it on.
Because people are people, and it doesn't matter where they are. We talk about people being tired by too much consultation and that they don't help you make decisions. It's all a nonsense. If people feel like they can make a small difference to the world, if they feel like they can be at all influential, if you get them to understand that the world is full of trade-offs, just as Ian said, it's not present giving, they make wise decisions. And the extraordinary magic of it is that they're always in the public good. I have never, in every, and I have run 40 and more, they have never come up with something that is in personal interest. Even to the point where, of all people to be randomly sampled in our future infrastructure budget in Geraldton, was the multi-millionaire developer in Geraldton. He turned out to be a brilliant member. He stood up on day one and said, I have an admission. I am a major developer up here. I have a personal interest. And I said, it's wonderful here. You're here representing everybody. Welcome. And he did just that. So there isn't a person who isn't willing to take on the public good when they understand the issues, I have found.
From Swinburne University, Associate Professor Andrew Dodd is moderating a discussion between Professor Janet Hartz-Karp of the Curtin University Sustainability Policy Institute and Ian Walker, CEO of the New Democracy Foundation.
In a sense, I'm thinking this is all too good to be true. Now, Ian, have you encountered these same kinds of reservations about new democracy, participatory democracy in the councils, the areas that you've worked in, and have you overcome them in the same way that Jeanette has?
I'm not short of people with reservations. I took a hideous call from someone who was actually a federal senator, and I don't have a PG version of what he said. It would essentially be, you're the little person who's trying to put people like me out of a job. And I remember simply saying to him, understanding the jury models that we pick people at random, is your concern that major decisions are going to be left to people who might be the night manager at Pioneer Concrete or filling in super forms for an organisation and faxing them through on a Friday afternoon? And the answer came back, you're bloody right, that's exactly who I want to avoid. And I said, unfortunately, I've just described the Prime Minister's last job before entering Parliament. Tony Abbott was the night manager at Pioneer Concrete, if you check his Wikipedia profile. And at the time, Stephen Conroy was actually a superannuation administrator.
Well, I must say, I didn't
within
know
the
that.
Union movement. And it was just an example of, we see people making decisions and they look wonderful in ties and their suits on the news every night, and we think this must be an incredibly difficult job, only you are capable of it. And in practice, what you want is a diversity of people in the room. The more we end up with a random sample that has a childcare worker, a teacher, a carpenter, a plumber, an engineer, a lawyer, whoever we get, it's the mix of people working together. We don't hit wildcard results. We have taken on things that caused my phone to ring. We did an energy inquiry for the New South Wales Parliament. So a Liberal government, roughly at the time that the federal opposition was campaigning against the carbon tax. And absolutely the wonderful former politicians who sit behind me had a wry laugh and said, you really want to take on an energy inquiry right now? We delivered a result where people found common ground. So, and it wasn't just a supermajority. They actually reached a unanimous set of recommendations to deliver back to the Parliament. And a bipartisan committee took it back to the Parliament, and laws in New South Wales changed. That's kind of the one measure for success we have. Are we getting different laws as a result of doing them? Ideally, we do this enough times that, yes, people start to look at these random juries and say, I kind of like how they work. We should do more of them. Maybe even to the point that tough decisions that are taken by our elected houses, if they're also supported by a randomly drawn group of people, does that help you trust the decision a little more? For me, the more I see, the more it's yes.
And no kittens were harmed in the energy inquiry?
Look, the best... I think I want to give you one kind of example of how people get to a degree of specificity. And it's... I feel like Kevin Rudd when I say that. But there's a point in the alcohol inquiry, Safe and Vibrant Nightlife, that we did for Premier Wetherill. And one of the results that came back essentially looked at the fact that in Adelaide at the time, you couldn't serve food and play music in a licensed venue before 9 p.m. So in short, you care about, you have a safer environment if every punter on the streets is 20 years old, you get a given level of violence. If there are people of various ages, 20, 30, 40, 50, and they've all had an equivalent amount to drink, just the diversity of ages will make a city safer. So people had said, well, I want things that are age-related to those in their 40s, or at different ages, why can't I go out and drink and dine and have live music? We asked them who they'd trust to inform themselves, and they asked for a liquor licensing lawyer with more than 20 years of experience of helping proponents. And this is where that deliberative component comes in, because you ask people to let them choose their own expertise. And they found this lawyer who went through and essentially showed them where all the bodies were buried in the Licensing Act. When that eventually went back to Cabinet, went back to the Premier who'd commissioned it and the Attorney General, I sat in the meeting when they discussed what they were going to go ahead with. And they looked at this component related to licensing law. And I won't dob on anyone, but people just laughed and said, who knew that was on the books? We expect our elected representatives to know everything about everything. And it's implausible. There's some things that are just on the books from years ago. And it's unreasonable to expect them to dig it up. A diverse group of people, given time, will deliver parliaments a very fresh look at problems. And if it's useful, what a great environment that a mixed group of people could find something they could agree on. We tend to find oppositions of either party tend to look at it and think, this is the wrong fight to pick.
Well, we're lucky to have with us in the audience a person representing a city council, Councillor Stephen Mayne is an elected councillor for the City of Melbourne. And Stephen, you had a lot to do with bringing the citizen jury concept to Melbourne, and last year pioneering a very big project called the People's Panel, where you brought 43 people together to deliberate about how vast amounts of money could be spent or would be spent over a 10-year period in Melbourne. Why and how did you make this happen?
Well, there'd been a council election and new people got elected, and the Greens were very strong on community engagement, and I was chair of Finance and Governance Committee, and I was very strong on transparency and open government. So those sort of two forces came together, and we said we want to do something with deliberative democracy and participatory democracy. And then we started talking to the officers, and it was the officers who actually came up and said, well, why don't you do the 10-year plan? Because at the moment we don't have one. So we'd all said we're going to do our first ever 10-year plan. And then officers might be nervous about the public coming in and turning over an existing policy, but where it was a blank piece of paper, we thought, why not give the community the first go to guide us as part of our community engagement for that first ever effort? So that was sort of how it all came together. Ian came in and presented on behalf of New Democracy to all councillors, did very well, was impressive, and so he was an outsourced option to deliver the process and the specifics of it. That's how it happened, and we've been absolutely thrilled with the result of it.
Were there some of those initial fears that Jeanette talks about in Geraldton, in Melbourne, such as the fear that it was too high a risk, that the people being brought in might have agendas, that they'd be driven by self-interest? Were there those sorts of fears? There must have been. And how did you process them?
All those risks. I mean, the usual squeaky wheel community groups were demanding that why weren't they invited onto the panel? You know, that if all the various resident associations, so we neutralised that by saying they could come along and observe, and they were able to watch the panel operate, but they weren't allowed to be on it. But I think that strengthened the randomness of it. And the key early decision we made was to have 50% business and 50% residential. So we couldn't just have it hijacked by the residents when this is a capital city and commerce and business is important as well. But look, people were sceptical. Anyone who's got power doesn't want to hand it over. So we had to push hard. It wasn't sort of everyone said, this is terrific. I mean, politicians everywhere will resist this. And even some of the recommendations. I mean, our Lord Mayor is a low-tax Lord Mayor, and the People's Panel recommended a 30% rate rise over 10 years. So we're still wrestling with how we answer that quandary of advice or political positions. But it's unearthed a whole bunch of new information. It killed stone dead my plans to privatise Citywide, which is our big services business that we own. They just said, don't do it. I gave up on that because they had political credibility. And if 43 people can look at that issue and say, that is a core asset, you should own it, it makes $10 million a year, don't sell it, who was I to try and resist that? So they've had influence already, but the real test will be over the next 5 or 6 years as to how many of the recommendations are actually implemented.
You've alluded to a very important point here, and that's the process of negotiating authority right up front, so that the people coming in and doing the citizens' jury or the jury members have a good, strong sense of how much authority they've got before the process starts. Now, is that something you've had to negotiate along the way?
It's something I do every... If you're going to do deliberative democracy, it has to be about power. I mean, it's the elephant in the room. We keep calling community engagement when we're giving people zero power. No wonder they feel tokenistic and used. So every time I do this, there is an agreement up front of the extent of influence. Now, it might be from when I did one with the Minister McTiernan, where Main Roads were trying to put an exit from a freeway, and neither suburb would have it. It was 10 years of a mini Bosnia, of these suburbs arguing about who was going to get it. We did a jury, half and half. They came up with exactly the same thing as Main Roads wanted, but that jury was told up front, I will do what you say, providing it's not $100,000 more than what I was already going to do. The difference between what the jury came up with and Main Roads is that Main Roads thought this was an issue of NIMBY, not in my backyard, nobody wanted it in their backyard. It wasn't, apparently. It was an issue of a playground and a school. And these jury, within a half a day, had come to the decision unanimously about doing it the way Main Roads wanted it, and then spent the other half a day spending the $100,000 on how to make safety precautions for the school and for the playground. And guess what? The whole issue ended. the road's there, there isn't a problem. So it's not that government doesn't know. It's not that we don't have experts. It's just that lay people, when they don't have an interest, will help you do something that's implementable. It's not all that difficult to understand.
How did you, Ian, negotiate authority with the Melbourne City Council before you started the Citizen Jury with them? What did you do?
I mean, my life's easy to one extent because we're not a consultant. We're philanthropically backed. I can smile sweetly at everyone. We don't have to chase work. And that's a really useful starting point as well, because even the community's used to seeing a parade of consultants, and somehow that consultant's still there 3 years later. Is this the new teat at which you feed? We conduct a really open session with any government entity that wants to work with us. A workshop's a really good way to get everything out. This is not unmitigated, unalloyed good news. You know, this is a risky exercise. Make sure you have a really good reason for doing it. Make sure all possible decisions are in play. Stephen Mayne made a great point just then, the blank sheet of paper. Government has got very used to consulting by saying, here's our solution. Give us comments. And then it's the greatest Where's Wally exercise you've ever seen. You take the draft, you take the final, I challenge you to find a difference. You want to know why citizens don't turn up? Because they're not idiots. They have better ways to spend their time. Invert that. Don't present a draft solution. Share the problem.
So how did you negotiate it with Melbourne?
We discussed our methodology. We went through five simple points, chatted through the principles of our approach. So we start through things like random selection. Things like, we're going to need to give these people a lot of time. This is going to be 40, 50 hours over 3 months. We are not going to be finished quickly. Access to information. What council information can they have access to? Let's start with everything and work backwards. Let's talk about authority. So that was, you can start to see we stepped through some principles. We had a great Q&A session, in as much as I think most councillors had really genuine questions in terms of how would this work? Can I put these people in? What would be the dynamic? So we discuss them. We give them straight answers and you make a decision. Know the risks you're going into. You're going to get an uncontrolled result.
So, Ian, you're saying some people at Melbourne City Council said, can we put these people on the jury?
That's a legitimate question.
Did that happen, Stephen?
Yeah. Oh, people wanted to, you know, allow resistance groups to be on or have experts on there, but Ian was very strong on the randomness of it.
So did that take a bit of thinking about, the idea that this really does have to be a random selection?
Yeah, that was the most challenging element, that it could be any old person. So, but we were able to influence that. We wanted diversity in age, gender, geographic location, and that vital split between business and residential. And I mean, if you look at it and say, the recommendations were very anti-car. So it was very much get the cars off, more bike paths, etc. And we didn't actually put a cohort in there, which is people who drive to the city to work every day. So maybe the way you select who's on the panel does influence that, and we didn't cater for that cohort, although we all agree with the outcome in terms of that recommendation.
To build on this point, I'm aware when I say random selection, most people I sit in front of are picturing the TAB at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday. They are not having a great idea at random selection. And when you turn that around and you say 95% of the population has a job, lives a reasonable life, has hobbies, is just like you, it's who you see in the street walking past you every day. It's this room. It's who you're going to see as you head out to dinner tonight. Getting over that hurdle is one of the key first steps.
You're with Big Ideas on RN. Professor Janette Hartz-Karp and Ian Walker are in conversation with Andrew Dodd. And you've also heard from Stephen Mayne, councillor at the Melbourne City Council. Citizen juries are a way of participating actively in political decision-making. Let's go back to Swinburne University.
I think that there are political issues as well, and I think sometimes random selection, just random selection, is just too tough. And Alana, the minister, and I came up with a plan, and, you know, for better or for worse, we did this thing called a third, a third, a third. There are some times when you're just not going to get away with, either with the industry or with the newspapers, not including certain groups. So we did a third of the people via advertisement. We put advertisements everywhere, newspapers, in local cafes, everywhere we possibly could. That's one third of the people. These are the people who say, choose me, choose me. We put one third in of every citizens group we could think of. You get two reps. You can send us the Indigenous, the old, the drivers, the every group we could think of. That's one third. And the final third is the absolute random sample. And when we had a hugely contentious issue where there were absolute sides, that it seemed to be a good compromise. We mixed it up at every single table. So as we said, they always sat like bad weddings. They had to understand one another. So, I think the random sample is the ideal. And sometimes one does something different slightly. And providing you do that in a very rigorous way and you make it all transparent and you make sure that no one group is going to have influence over another group, but they hear each other. Another way is to make sure all the groups that you are talking about are considered experts and they get to speak to this random sample group. We'll often do it that way. Or a third way might be that you have an overseeing group and those sorts of groups are all on the overseeing group that decide how you will stratify your sample. So it's not as if there's only one way you can do this. As long as you're transparent, as long as it really makes sense and the politicians can live with it at the end of the day and will explain and will say that the extent of influence, then my suggestion would be go for it.
You described the results as recommendations. Did they have any more standing than that, or were they just recommendations?
Well, they're recommendations. We're releasing our 10-year plan, a first draft of it, in the next month. So we will see how many of the recommendations we've introduced. But we've insisted, we had a special council meeting to receive the report, and we've insisted that the 10-year plan explains how many of the recommendations we've adopted and where we haven't adopted them, why we haven't adopted them. So we are enforcing the officers to embed the advice and the response to the advice. And then, but obviously we can implement it every day of the week if, you know, with different little nips and tucks of policy. Just last Tuesday night, our motorbike plan came in and we made a change on the night, which was to get rid of 20 paid car parks in the city in the next 12 months and turn them into free motorcycle corrals. And the people panel had recommended get the motorbikes off the footpaths. And so this was just one little tiny implementation we did as an amendment by the councillors, which hadn't come from the officers, last Tuesday night. And that's a, 1% little tick for implementing one of the many recommendations that the panel had told us to do.
One of the big arguments for this kind of democracy is it allows a council to do things that it otherwise wouldn't be able to do because of the nature of our electoral cycles, because of the nature of partisan politics, because the media will beat them up, things that have been alluded to. What has this process allowed you to do that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to do?
Well, getting the rate rise above inflation this year was an easier argument with the Lord Mayor and with others. So we were at 3.6%, and previously, we had a rate freeze 3 years ago where we were zero, and we put that extra money into replacement of LED street lighting and solar panels on our buildings, which again was this sustainability recommendation which came through from the panel. So, look, the really hard ones will be the sustained rate rises and that heavy investment in infrastructure. We'll just have to see how we go with
this
that.
This will give you some political cover, though, won't it? You can, in a sense, now blame the citizen jury for the decisions you weren't able to make yourself.
Canada Bay, that was probably the biggest takeout, was the above-expected rate rise recommended by the citizens up there.
So does this happen in citizen juries where you cherry-pick, you take the things that are politically difficult and you leave the ones that you just don't want to do as a council because you're not adopting everything. But for you, it's very convenient to take the ones that give you political cover that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to do.
Well, I'm actually interested in the model working. And so my starting position is let's try and implement as much as we damn well can to try and help prove up the model. Because frankly, some of the things we are doing anyway, I mean, we're full on with bike paths and sustainability and these things anyway. It's given more credibility to that so we can push harder, if you like, on those areas. But there are other areas such as cranking up developer contributions. I mean, the developers hate that. And we've had a record haul of $10 million this year, and I'm pushing hard to bring in much more because we're $50 million behind Sydney, which is making so much from developers. So that recommendation has helped with that difficult argument. Developers will be upset. But our panel have told us, bring in more cash from that and stop being addicted to car parking revenue.
Look, the measure of success is never every recommendation getting adopted. I think that's an absolutely artificial goal. And by way of comparison, I'd probably point you towards the Henry Tax Review, 138 recommendations. One and a half of them got put in place. One of them raised no money and half of them got rid of a prime minister. So your hit rate on the traditional way of trying to change policy is not fantastic. With everyday people we pick at random, they're not like activist groups. An activist group can have 10 things they want done, and if government agrees to 9, the headline is about the one they didn't do, and they'll keep campaigning on it. What we've shown with everyday people is we show them a problem, and if they come up with 5 recommendations, and 3 of them get done, Well, that's a pretty good use of my time. The government listened to me and did three things. Sure, two didn't, but that's because this is at its core. I can't turn people into experts. We give government clarity of intent about what people care about. There will always be another layer of implementation, and as you get down to the detail, that not everything can be implemented. This is where it comes back to the genuine response. Actually, just say to people, we did do this, we didn't do this bit. As long as people get a straight answer, that is more than you actually get from any government engagement process I can think of at the moment. Government will ask you about various topics. Thank you for your submission. It is noted.
Have there ever been any errant results in the same way that a jury every now and again will come out with something absolutely wacky?
Yeah.
And everybody has to live with it, particularly in those situations where you give the jury full authority and you say, we will legislate whatever you come up with. Has that ever happened?
Yeah, it certainly did. And it was a huge test for me. So we had a city and it was very split about where all the new administration was going to go, outside or inside, and the planners all said 100% it's got to go in the middle of the city because that's where you have a central administration. So the minister went in being absolutely certain that these people, being having common sense, would also put it in the middle of the city. And this jury did not. They put it out of the city. They explained their views to her. They explained it to the media. And I thought, you know, this is my... I'm either going to leave the office at this point if she won't go along with it, or else I'm going to stay here, because you can't just always get what you want. She said to them, okay, I'm going to do it in this instance. This will not be policy. I want to make this publicly clear. I will not do this in any other instance unless people can absolutely convince me of their reasons. I understand your reasons. This is not good general practice. So, no, they don't always come up with what the experts would say is right. And that is the way it goes sometimes. It made sense to them.
Did anything go wrong in the Melbourne model?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the 75% supermajority requirement to get approval probably watered down a little bit of the granularity of the detail. So, you know, a core group of 26%, which might have been, what, 8 or 9 people, could effectively, that's off the table. So maybe a lower majority threshold for things being included would have seen a little bit more breadth and depth than the 11 recommendations we've got, which were still very, very broad. But I know that a few things hit the cutting room floor in that final 75% threshold voting system as to what's in and what's out.
Ian, this is essentially it's a process of trial and error. In fact, your organisation is a research organisation. You try new things. There must have been failures.
Things always go wrong. My job is much like why people watch motor racing and bomb disposal. It's that secret hope that it will go colourfully wrong. And that's the nature of it. We put a random group of people in the room. We don't know where they'll go. There are no wrong answers in many things in government. In the City of Melbourne case, they've come back and said, we're happy for rates to go up 5.5% per year, compounding over 10 years. They could equally have asked them to go down 5.5% per year, compounding downwards. There's not a right answer. There's just what a community says, I could live with that and I like it. We haven't seen something go radically wrong and off the rails. I've had one where in the energy inquiry we were doing, someone had made an expert submission and under questioning essentially came unstuck. A citizen asked a question related to his area of expertise, and the given expert responded by saying, I've been a consultant in this area for 32 years. My data comes from the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and NASA's JPL. It's very complicated. You wouldn't understand. And the citizen concerned said, well, you could try me. I'm a physics teacher. And as a result, the expert fell apart and turned off his camera. Essentially, we cut it short. One could argue that went wrong. I'm quite happy to sit there and say, well, that's the point. And I'm happy to say that one of the Liberal MPs who commissioned us did lean in and say, thank God we did this. We quite liked his submission. The point I'm making is MPs can come from a relatively narrow range of expertise and background. By random selection, I happen to have a teacher in the room who could interrogate just that one specific question, as there were other people with other skills who could go to that point. Diversity of life and experiences saves you a lot of hardship and gets you to better decisions. yes, things go wrong, but the only thing that really matters at the end is the decision that you get and whether it gets adopted. There's one measure for community engagement. Did the decision change?
I imagine for this to work, you've got to give the process adequate time. Have there been instances where that hasn't, you know, where you haven't got the timing right?
We've come close on one where we, if you look back honestly, say we didn't have enough time going in. We discussed it with the council concerned. They knew we were short of time, we're willing to take the risk. And it was fairly evident that citizens got a long way through the problem and just cut off another part of it. We saw a council try to, who we were in discussions with, and we said, you're doing this with too little time, we're not going to do it. They went ahead with a consultant anyway, and exactly what you would think would happen is the citizens looked at it and said, you're trying to push us through to a fixed decision that you already know. And they all revolted and they refused to do anything. I hate to say it, but I look at that and say, that's a fabulous result. That's a stress test that if you try to cheat it, it breaks. We should embrace things that break like that.
What else have you learned about how to do this better, how to do this kind of participatory democracy better?
Yeah, I think one is you have to trust. And when things aren't going right, it's almost like Ian is saying, is you need to learn to hand over and say, okay, it's not working here. What are we going to do to make this work? Small things like we had one person in, when we were at Geraldton, we had a participatory budget on the long-term strategic budget. We had one person in the room who was the most racist man I have ever come across, ever. He couldn't stand Indigenous people and chose every minute of every session to say how much money we're wasting on Indigenous
and
people.
And roughly 17-20% of the population in Geraldton is Indigenous.
Exactly. We had two Indigenous people in the room. We found out that with the Indigenous guy, he was equally horrible. And with the Indigenous woman, who was an elder, he absolutely changed. So we did what we normally don't do, and we sat him purposely next to her the whole way through. But that was really because she was, her wisdom was able to keep an impossible situation with a lid on. So I think one of the things I've learned is I've just got to trust in not thinking I can orchestrate this.
But you
people
did orchestrate
are really
that.
Smart.
You sat them together.
Well, no, it happened. And then we realised what happened. And having realised what happened, we maximised it, asked her if she minded. She said no. And it continued. But it is still saying, you know, people can tell you stuff. Or, you know, when you're cross-examining it, just hand it over to them. Like Ian said, they will soon find the holes in people's arguments. So it's that whole thing of, for me, trusting wisdom. That's tough when one's supposed to be an expert oneself.
In a sense, Stephen, you've been an agent of change making this happen at Melbourne City Council. Where's it going to go from here?
Well, after attending Jeanette's six-hour masterclass at City of Melbourne yesterday with about 40 of our staff, I am more impressed with the whole model than before, ever before. So I did say to my council colleagues about 2 hours ago that when we had our regular Tuesday council-only meeting that I'd like to do one more before the election, and we need to start turning our minds to what topic that might be, whether it's tobacco, how fast we roll out the tobacco smoking bans in the streets.
And this is in your capacity as chair of the Finance
and Governance Committee, yeah. So we need to get budget, because one of the challenges, we need to find a lower cost model to do this with technology and do this quite nimbly on multiple issues, I think is how I'd like to see it going. So one thing I'm thinking about is, can we tap into the existing knowledge of our 43 who were highly engaged and remain highly engaged and turned up for six full sunny Saturdays, and we were expecting a drop off down to about low 30s, and we still had 42 at the end, whether we can go back to them and tap their knowledge on some tricky decisions over
the
next 15 months.
The last thing you want to do, though, is you don't want to professionalise the citizen jury. That's the last thing.
I think hopefully we've got a couple of candidates at the next election out of them. I think we've really civilly educated and inspired some of them, and some of them are excellent, and I think they make really good councillors. So I'd love to see one of them graduate through and become a
voting... But you've got to keep
voting...
taking risks with this model,
Stephen,
haven't you?
I hate to break it to you. There's actually a line in our proposals that say the group will never be reused. So that's why we don't. It's also why we never hand over your contact details to you.
Stephen,
so good
Stephen
luck
is,
contacting them.
Stephen is looking crestfallen at this point, I'd like to know. So is that what you want to do? Do you want to keep people working in the system, or do you want to turn them over?
But the fact of the matter is that people do become a whole lot more civically conscious as a result of this. And, for example, one person out of our our citizens' parliament immediately left. She was the youngest in the room. She was 17. We had the oldest and the youngest standing up the front. And at the end of the day, she stood up there and she said, I am going to change the world and I'm going to be the first female prime minister of Australia. She wasn't, but that's beside the point. But she left and she worked for a Greens office. I mean, who knows if that's going to happen or not. We've done, in America, there's been research that's been done, and even on juries as well as citizens' juries, people who take part in them are more likely to vote, they're more likely to get involved in civic life, they're more likely to care about others. I mean, it does affect you.
I mean, one of the things that really leaps out at us, and it sounds inordinately, stupidly simple, but people emerge saying, government is hard.
Yes.
And there's a tendency for any of us who pick up a paper or watch the news, the core argument most media outlets put out there is, this is easy, you as our reader would make a different decision because it's so easy. And what we generally face is coming into the room, about a quarter of the room thinks they could solve any issue in the first hour and a half. And that's why we need so much time, is you just need to slow people down a little bit and then you start to realise you probably can't solve it in an hour and a half. But one of the key outputs is just having 40, 50 people who say, slow down, this is more complicated than it looks. If we do X, then here's the list of consequences. That in itself is a benefit to government.
So can I ask you both, what are the challenges remaining to keep it going and to go to the next level?
In simple terms, we do these processes because we want to show people an alternative. Everyone complains about how we do democracy. That's great, complain. But we also need to present and say, here's a different and complementary way of doing it. They're one-off pilots at this stage. The challenge is, how do you institutionalise it? How do you get to a point where it forms part of the natural structure of government? We have a mayor in Noosa who approached us, looking at City of Canada Bay, looking at City of Melbourne, said, I see what they do. I want to go a step further again. So I think we're close to getting to a point where we think of our democracy as being one part those that we vote for and one part picked at random. And for just certain hard decisions, not all of them, but just a handful of really hard decisions, the elected tier can share that decision, can share their recommendation and share it with a random group to say, does this have your consent? And when we can have that complementary piece of getting a consensus, getting a very large group of those people to say, we like that decision as well, that's going to build another layer of trust in how we do democracy. And that for us is the challenge, is everyone likes the one-off projects, generally because they solve a hard, awful problem that they've put in front of us. And we need to translate that to that it's not just about the next awful problem, it's about a structural change. We thought this would take 15 to 20 years. We hear from 5 councils a week at the moment and a number of state agencies as well. There is now starting to be a competitive appetite that the positive in this is people are starting to realise that there's electoral advantage. If you can run on reforming how we do democracy, starting to look pretty appealing to voters as well.
There's a huge amount to left to win and innovate to do, because the fact of the matter is we have not yet institutionalised. And it is very difficult. And there's a real and to me. It's not just making this business as usual. It's making this continually innovative. I mean, we don't know how to do democracy. I really don't think we're all that good at getting people to do critical thinking. So how do we not just make this business as usual? Because otherwise, my fear is, we'll just get to basic minimum requirements and we'll end up with yet another problem.
Professor Janet Hartz-Karp of the Curtin University Sustainability Policy Institute, Ian Walker, CEO of the New Democracy Foundation, and Stephen Mayne, councillor at the Melbourne City Council. Andrew Dodd, Program Director of Journalism at Swinburne University, moderated this Swinburne Leadership Dialogue. Thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.